So thank you very much, Benny, for bringing this film to us today. Do you want to reposition a little bit?
Yeah, I don't know.
Do you want to swap? I think that's a bit better. Ahoy there. Okay. Well, thank you, Benny. It was very, very moving film. I guess we might start a little bit about this decision to this. There was two decisions. Obviously, this decision to put the film out there anonymously as the Silent Collective, and then the second decision later to put your own name to it. And maybe if you could tell us a little bit about the times that you made those decisions, because I know the times were a little bit different each time, but it wasn't just a matter of time passing, but the conditions were changing as well.
Yeah. Thank you first of all to invite me here with the film and so I can show it. Thanks for coming to the screening. When I first was working on the film, I was not sure if I would do something or not with the images I had filmed during the elections and during the few days of the revolt. And I brought all my images out of Iran, and in the beginning I was somehow trying to get rid of all of this material because it was almost a burden for me. It was too much. Just the intensity of what I had gone through, and I didn't have an intention to make a film about what had happened. I was working on other projects, and also the situation in Iran at the time was obviously very difficult and repressive, and I had another film I needed to make there, and also traveling back and forth was important for me. But after a few months of kind of trying to find an outlet for the images, maybe another filmmaker who wanted to make a film or I don't know, television that needed some images, I realized that I had somewhat a responsibility towards all the people that had spoken in front of the camera. I couldn't give their images to other people, and in a way I also needed to continue what I had begun. It was not possible. So I was very lucky to have support from this festival, IDFA, in Amsterdam, who really protected my identity, and they gave me some funding to be able to take the time to edit the film. And then the whole process of making the film became something much bigger, like it expanded beyond my own footage, and I started to take things from the internet, and also as I was beginning, the revolt was continuing, so of course I was, you know, grabbing anything that was being posted and also following. And so in the end, I mean, I finished the film in 2010, in September of 2010, about a year and a couple of months after. And I decided that I didn't want to put my name on it because of still traveling back, and the situation was still quite quite bad there. I don't know, I first thought to make up a name or a pseudonym. I don't usually work that way, but I realized that it made no sense. Like, it's just creating this fake identity, which in a way I don't want to work that way. And I don't know, even now I leave that it says made by Silent Collective because there's so much material that comes from other sources, other people who are anonymous and somehow silent in a way, that I made up this fake collective, but it's also not fake. I feel that it even though people don't know that they're part of it, somehow they are. And the film was shown a little bit, and I completely detached myself. I tried to went on making all the work and doing things. And then the elections happened again in 2012, 2013. and the new president, and I don't know, it was an excuse for me to think that maybe it's better. And I had also wanted to just get the secret out, to not have carry the secret with me. And I had an opportunity to share the film with French critic Nicole Brunet, who then we discussed quite a bit, and I had wanted to have a chance to, you know, say that I had made the film officially, so I'm not carrying the secret with me. So in a way, the fact that she wanted to write about the film allowed me to use that as a platform. And that was about now 2 years ago.
Yeah, the Silent Collective, the images that you collected in this film are particularly interesting because obviously seeing them on a big screen here as well, they're it's obvious enough that Bani has taken most of them from the internet, from YouTube and so on, and some of the footage that you shot yourself as well. Mm. But maybe it'd be interesting to hear a little bit about that process of like what to choose and how to go into that. And I guess this idea of the archive, which is something that in the Essay Film Festival, especially this year, we're having a very special focus on the kind of compilation film and the use of archive in essay filmmaking. But usually it's quite historical material, whereas this you were using, especially at that time, very fresh material. It's still quite fresh. And as you just said there, when you started making it, you didn't really know that you were making this kind of film because you didn't know what was going to happen,
right?
I guess as well. But yeah, I mean, then with the archive footage as well, there's this, you put in conversation, obviously, the historical material with the newer material. And watching it this time, this is my third time seeing it, when the Shah comes on towards the end, it's like the Shah is speaking to from the past to now and vice versa. Right. And it's like setting up this history repeating itself thing. So, yeah, I mean, how much of that was conscious or meant?
Yeah, completely, definitely conscious. I mean, I decided quite quickly that I did not want to make a journalistic film about what just happened, nor about what is still happening and the Green Movement or whatever this idea is, that it was a movement as per se. What interested me from, you know, the first day that that the revolt, or let's say the, you know, everyone went to the streets, what interested me also filming was, you know, why am I filming this? And also how we all reacted so quickly to the election results, and the way that in a way we knew how to be in the streets together in a country where it's very difficult to be in the streets together in this way. So this was amazing for me. I got this inspiration, but also confusion from when I was filming. And then realizing that there was so many things that people were saying and repeating that I had heard before, definitely, or had seen before in other images, in films or photographs or stories my parents or my grandparents or other family members had told me. So I definitely, had this burning question of how do we know what we want and what to do when we can't be in the streets together discussing it, which also made me quite afraid, like how quickly the revolt took this momentum. So this was more of what I was hoping to work with in a very general way. And once I began to work with my material and I created this sort of personal archive of all the stuff I was finding on YouTube and also all the historical images or references are also part of a, you know, really long research I did, and there's many things that are not explained or names are not given. For an Iranian audience, maybe they know some of these symbols of the people who are hanged or important people from 100 years ago. So in a way, I thought, okay, now I need to allow history to dialogue amongst itself, just as I feel like it was happening for people subconsciously, maybe, you know, I don't think that all the youth know exactly who some of these characters are, these people are, but I think that somehow I'm reflecting somehow on a maybe collective history, to use a kind of common term now. But this was the point for me. And the role of the archive in that, like, whether it be a filmic archive or photo archive. Oh, yeah. Okay. Photo archive or even stories, you know, or what we hear and what we share, and how this is what allows us to maybe maintain this this common need that takes us to the streets over and over again. Because as I was doing a lot of research, I realized that the revolts about the tobacco reform in 1905 had similar discourse as a lot of the things we were doing in the streets or in 1953 around Mossadegh. So I realized it's not like we can't say completely continual and continuous maybe struggle, but there are things that repeat and are interrupted and come back. So
thank you. Yeah, I was also struck listening to you just now, also the, this, you know, your kind of the fervor, I guess, or the collective solidarity that you felt during that movement. And I think I have felt that in other movements I've been involved in. And then to imagine you sort of editing and being left with this responsibility mm-hmm. of the footage that you tried to give away at certain points, but you felt in the end you had to take it. Mm-hmm. And then inventing the collective and calling in all of this footage from places, almost like that you were sort of working, even though you were working on your own, because Bani was telling me earlier she worked mostly on her own rather than with an editor as well, with the material. Mm-hmm. And so yet it's like this very alone work, but you've invented this collective in terms of the pseudonym, but also as an idea of maybe when you leave that protest and you're alone, how much you miss that that solidarity that you felt, the collective people coming together. I mean, is that something that you feel is still there, or is something that can happen again now for you?
I don't know if I understood the question.
Well, it was a little bit of a reflection, I guess. The question being, I mean, if through the film somehow that you feel that it's that somehow that the film goes back to the collective again, if you like, and is owned by the collective.
Yeah, I mean, it, in a way, it's just it's what I could offer, you know, with what I understood from what happened, and maybe just to leave this as an archive too for future reference. But it's also one point of view of the situation and all this material. I mean, the voiceover is written by me, and it's my point of view. It's not, I mean, this is also an essay film. I think this, whether it's personal or not, is not important. It's not about me, but it is what I'm offering with this material. So, but I mean, it's, access to the film is very limited too in an Iranian context. I had put it on YouTube for a while, but I sometimes, you know, would just look to see, and I don't think many people would see it. The internet is not so great in Iran, even the high speed, to watch things like this, and people are sometimes afraid. I don't know. Also, now other things are happening. So it's also maybe part of the past already, although it's still there, of course.
And writing the voiceover, because the voice, even though you've written the material, it's not your voice, but still it's the same voice throughout, and it's obviously quite a, you know, it's very authored text. But as you made it as the Siding Collective, I mean, you decided to give the voice to somebody else, I guess, to protect your own identity, but also you could have chosen to have multiple voices to sort of represent this idea of the collective, for example. Mm. But you chose to keep this one voice that when we watch, we presume is you.
Right. Yeah, I think I have an accent when I speak Farsi. And also I don't know. It was also somebody quite close to me that knew about the thing and wanted to somehow help me. And she helped me. I mean, I wrote it and she helped me make it better in terms of language. And she has quite a nice voice, so I had her read it. I mean, I felt like the film goes in so many directions as well that somehow a constant factor like the same voice would be, I don't know, the contact that the spectator could have with the film, like a direct contact. So this is probably why I decided, because there's so many other multiple voices that it would have been confusing to have different voices for the voiceover, I think.
Yeah, it works. I mean, you trust this voice as your guide. And mm-hmm. Yeah, I think with the essay film as well, the voice is so important, because you can sort of do too much or too little, but it's like you've come in at the right moments in a more poetic as well as political manner. Mm-hmm. I'll throw it out to the floor now if anybody's got questions. We've got a mic here. So 1, 2, and 3.
Okay.
So this woman here first, and this row, I think her hand is the first, then yourself, and then up the back.
Hi. I wanted to ask you, when you were releasing 2009 or 2010, that you said, the film, who did you think your audience would be? Or which audience were you interested in, basically? Meaning the Iranian or non-Iranian audience like we are now, or North America, I think, that you also released it. That's one question. And the second question is, how did you think this film would function if it was exposed within the Iranian society, if you had any ideas around that?
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. The question about who your audience is when you make a film is always difficult, because I don't know if of course it's something we think about, but at the same time, I think when you're making a film, depending, okay, how you work, but the way I work is the film is more powerful than what I want it to be, in a way, like what it asks me to do, I don't know. The material, and I can only work through the way I'm able to speak or to write. So I think in a way this kind of expression also through essay, if we call it an essay, you know, I don't know. I didn't think it's a film essay when I made it. I made a film with this material and I needed a voice for this reason and that reason. And I think when I made it, I needed to put all the things that I needed to put there, and I think probably half of it a foreign audience might not understand with the amount of detail that an Iranian audience, and also an Iranian audience is, depends. I mean, if the person has been exposed to certain things or knows certain things, so also that is, but I think obviously I wanted the most amount of people to see it. But it was and is important for me that it's a document for my people, if I say it like that, because I feel that we need to discuss more what our history is. This was maybe my hope. Now, I don't know. Reaction from Iranian audience, I don't know what I expected. I just made the film, and then you hope that, you know, it provokes thought, provokes discussion, and I don't know, and unsettles, because it was, the events were unsettling for me, and I think when you start to research and read and know more about history in any context, it's unsettling in a way, because it makes things more complex. And when things become complex, then you have a harder time, acting, you know, immediately, or it makes things more difficult and more work, and this is, you know, what I strive for maybe with the film, and yeah. I don't know if that answered.
Okay, yourself.
About halfway through the film, you seem to be walking through the street and a man says to you, "You're filming, can I buy your thing?" And you just hold the camera a little bit on him. Do you think he's from the government? Or do you think he genuinely wants to keep it for his archive?
No, it's... I don't know if he's from the government, but I don't think he has good intentions. when he asks me, and he's obviously not from the government. The way he does it for me was so obvious, and we were all in the streets, and all, it's like everyone was there, you know, we were all together, so you had to come across people who are on the other side or who you don't know who they're working with. But they also had to deal with us in a way. We were more, there was more of us. So it was this very, it was like this, it was during the, what that was filmed. Yeah, during the campaign, I think, even before the sort of revolt. So I can't remember now, but he was trying to get, you know, images of people, I imagine. I don't know, maybe he was genuinely interested, I don't know.
But do you think he wanted to take them off you so that you wouldn't have them and he'd get, like, be able to get rid of them, or he wanted to do something with them?
No, get rid of them, no. I don't know. You know, we all have our paranoias. So for me, that guy, and that's why I put him in the film there, is he wanted to have images of people who were not just protesting, but I'm pretty sure it was before the, because I was walking with this group of youth who were like activists, and it was quite free those days to be in the streets and say what you wanted, but obviously there was people watching and taking images too, and also wearing green things and blending in. The whole sequence after is lots of cameras, and you know, you don't know which one of these people works for the government or for whoever else. So,
okay, third time lucky.
Thank you for showing the film. I was very moved by it. I suppose my question would be that obviously so much has changed in the 5-6 years since the revolt itself. And my question would be, in context of other revolts, uprisings in the Arab world since then, do you feel that the appetite for revolution has changed in Iran or morphed since then into something different? Do they still see that revolution as being something that can end well with the examples of Egypt and Libya and perhaps elsewhere? How has the vision of revolution changed in context of uprisings in the Arab world?
I think the word revolution is quite problematic. I think even in the Arab countries or Arab Spring, is all these words that don't really describe the realities of anything that happened in any of those countries. And I think the feeling I got in Iran, and I used to get a lot, is that revolution was not something people wanted. I don't think people in Iran are on a revolution. I don't think the Green Move. It was about voting and getting the vote back, and it was about, you know, making changes slowly. And I think that it's false ideas around what a revolt means. A revolt is not always to, you know, revolution. We had a revolution in Iran. We had a few. But this maybe could have been, but I don't know if that's what people wanted, and if that's, I don't know. That's something that we would have to do a study, a deeper study to. But yeah, I don't know. I think, this happened, and then Egypt happened 2 years after, or Tunisia before, I don't remember now. But of course it was really interesting. I was in Tehran when end of January in, 2011, when Egypt, you know, everyone was in Tahrir, and it was really interesting to see it being inside Iran, having lived this, but I don't know how much they provoke each other. I don't know. This is, I don't know who to ask. Who would know that?
I mean, from what I heard, I mean, it was even criticized for not being revolutionary enough because it wasn't far left or anything. It was like the Green Movement. I don't know if you would agree with that.
But I don't know if in the Arab countries it was far left. I don't know.
Not far left.
Idea we have.
Compared to the revolution before, I would say. But
right. Yeah, it's complex. I think it's.
Okay, we had a question from the back there.
Hi, I was really interested how in the film you kept on returning to images of statues being toppled. And at one point, I think in the voiceover, you said something like, or not you, but the person reading the voiceover says something like, the symbols of this regime will one day be destroyed. And I think you said something like, it will amount to an erasure of history, or it will, or, you know, that's an act of erasing history. And I wonder what you think of the current debate about the place of physical symbols and how we remember history, particularly in light of things like anti-colonial struggles and the Roads Must Fall movement. Where do you stand on the debate about that?
I didn't understand the last part.
So there's been a lot of debate recently about how important symbols are in the way that we remember recently, and particularly there's been a lot of anti-colonial movements which have focused their attentions on removing from public places statues of colonial oppressors like Cecil Rhodes. His statue was removed from the University of Cape Town in 2010. There have been attempts to have his statue removed from a facade of a building in Oxford, and I thought of that in the line in the film where you talked about how the symbols of the regime would be destroyed and how that would be erasing history. And I wonder what you think about that. So maybe that didn't make any sense, did it?
No, it makes sense. I don't have a definite position about that. I think that it's depending on the context. I mean, recently I was in Berlin I'm going on a very different line just to reflect on it because I was in Berlin and they have these little golden plaques in cobblestones in the street to mark some people they know were deported to the camps or killed. And it's very interesting, but I have a problem with the way it's presented, for example, in that context. But I entered debate with a lot of people there and I don't know. I have a very instinctive thing thinking this should not be on the ground. It's not like it's sacred or something, but I think a lot of people don't see it. They just walk on top of it if it's covered in snow. Of course, I still feel like we should mark history's passings and also the violence, which we're capable of. It's interesting to see layers of this violence through, but I think I don't know if it's about preserving statues necessarily. I think it happens in many contexts in very interesting ways. Artists that do projects that reenact statues or put statues in places that they were not before, and so it's I don't have we need to keep all the statues of our oppressors, and it's also depending what side of the story you stand on, who the oppressor is. So yeah, I don't know. It's I can just reflect a little bit out loud about it.
Thank you. Do we have time for more questions, Leah?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Taggy.
Thank you. Very powerful piece of filmmaking, and as you said, I think it'll stand the test of time as a historical document. But in terms of accuracy, and forgive me if I'm wrong, but I was in Iran during those elections, and early in your film, you have a scene of street riots and dustbins burning, and the caption says June 13th, Election Day. Election Day was June the 12th, which was a Friday, and the riots didn't happen until the day after because the Election Day itself was a euphoric, happy day because people thought they got their way. So it might be worth double-checking the caption and the accuracy of that date.
Okay, do we have any more questions? I think we have time for one more. Yes?
Could you say something about the position of women? Because it comes up, I just wonder if there's anything you could say about the position of women in this context and this history.
Yeah, I mean, we see a lot of women that are active there. I mean, women are very active in Iran, and they played a huge role in the debates and before the elections and the revolt. Yeah.
Okay, well, I want to thank you all again, and thank you, Bani, for making the trip. And please join us for the next few events. We'll be in the Goethe Institute tomorrow evening with Kidlati Himik. We have a day-long workshop on Tuesday. Is it Tuesday or Wednesday? Sorry, Wednesday. And then we have other screenings going on, and then we'll be back here on Wednesday with the host by Miranda Pinnell on Wednesday evening as well. Okay, thank you very much, and thanks again, Bani.
Thank you.